I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. We call it an American conversation with global attitude. We're at an odd intersection this time in Providence, Rhode Island, where new music and old stories come together with theater and all sorts of inspired new imagery from students at the Rhode Island School of Design. The Scots teller of all the world's stories, Ben Haggerty, is one big element here. Yo-Yo Ma's Silk Road Ensemble of International Instrumentalists are another. And then the up-and-coming furniture makers and book illustrators at RISD have a go at staging it all. Ben Haggerty, I want to hear all about the collaboration, but just give us the theory and practice of stories. I always want to ask somebody like you, I mean, how many stories are there in the world? Are there six? Are there 6 billion? Where do we begin? But tell us about your own practice and how you get into it.
Well, your first question very specifically was, are there 6 stories or 6 billion stories? And I would say there's 6 billion times probably that again. Because there's a sort of mentality that wants to reduce everything these days to, you know, to 6 or 7 basic stories. But if you have 10 people in a room and they're all telling the same story, you'll have 10 different versions because it speaks to different aspects of themselves. What I'm interested in is seeing how stories have traveled from really very remote archaeological times to the present day. You find there are motifs, there are images that have always spoken to people. And what you can do is you can represent them in a way that they hear them freshly, and it has new meaning. In the collaboration with RISD, it's very interesting and exciting situation. We have some very talented illustration students and students of other visual and plastic arts there. We have our musicians, we have me as a storyteller. We have a college supporting it, but we also have the element which is the Silk Road. My interest is in what Yo-Yo has been advocating for the last 7 or 8 years, which is this idea that there has always been, since human beings have traded and travelled, an exchange, cultural exchange. And so I presented a folder full of stories to the students, which showed very similar stories. I mean, in fact, I would say the same story being told as far west as Ireland and as far east as Japan. The same story. The thing that interests us actually is really deeper than the cultural superficiality. It's the human situation, the emotion behind the thing, or just the comedy, the humour, the daftness, the idiocy of the story. Amongst the stories that were given to the students is a story of two hunchbacks, and also a story of a man who goes looking for a piece of wood to fix a boat. And we gave them the hunchback story in, I think, Italian versions, Irish versions, and a Japanese version. Same story, 3 different cultures, slightly different nuances to the stories. And they've taken these stories, and what they're doing is revisualizing them. So they're taking the themes, and they're creating their own cultural context for it. The girls have taken this idea of the deformity of the hunchback, they've turned it into a skin condition and made a sort of contemporary story in this way. It's an interesting story, and I'm intrigued that they've chosen from the bundle of about 10 stories that I gave them to work with that one, because you know, not everything in tradition is good, and one of the difficulties is that up until very recently, really, one might say more enlightened times, physical deformity has been associated with punishment. So, you know, I threw them in, including that story. I set them a really contemporary task, that this is not a story that you can necessarily tell, and yet they've chosen to try and tell it. So I'm going to be very interested to see what they do with it.
Thank you.
The old folktale is variously called, well, it's either called The Two Hunchbacks or The Two Old Men Who Had Wens, and it's about two, often brothers, who have a physical deformity, and they go into the forest, and one of them is cured of the deformity through one of his acts, and the other one, because he acts wrongly, is punished and given the other deformity of the first guy. Like, you know, the one guy gets his hump removed, and then the other guy, not only does he not get his hump removed, but he gets the other guy's hump put on his back. And so Allie's story is about these two little girls who have skin like onions that's always peeling, but we wanted a more positive ending. We wanted, you know, it not to really be about punishment, since, you know, it's the end of the show and we're trying to make things a little more uplifting. So we all collaborated to change it so that one girl, because of her passion for music, is healed and she gets, you know, a brand new soft skin, and the other girl is taught a lesson and keeps her onion skin but gains a new instrument and gains new confidence and is able to live with her physical disability, which I think is a more modern adaptation than you know, oh, you're disabled, that's the end. Like,
okay. Well, one of the tough things, and I think this is for all of us, was trying to find a balance between, I guess, the volume of the different aspects, so like how much the music is going to carry the story and how much the set is going to carry the story and how much the verbal telling is going to tell the story at various points, and those can fluctuate. And so in thinking about building the sets, I think at points we were thinking, like in building these trees, which are just draped fabric, I think the thought was to be more abstract, more suggestive, in order to give the music or the telling of the story more room to carry the narrative and to carry the description.
I mean, I thought it was amazing to be able to work with these, you know, world-class musicians and have them integrate their music into stories that we've written. I mean, it's kind of amazing to hear the music that they play that just weaves so seamlessly into the stories that we're telling.
Co-speak for the musicians in this ensemble, in this Providence gig with RISD and Ben Haggerty, where does the music come from?
What happens is Ben is just a fantastic storyteller. He'll bring a story in. There's a narrative flow, obviously, because he's storytelling. And then we work out, here's an example. This story starts with a scene in a market. And it's a market sort of maybe in the evening time. And so Ben sets the mood and we try to figure out, okay, how can we musically represent this? And I know it sounds very simplistic, but we have to go through a series of experiments to find out what that particular atmosphere, what might be like. You know, is it going to be lyrical? Probably not. Is it going to be chaotic? How do you create the vibe of a market? So the solution, and this particular solution for today, and it might just go away, you know, when I go back to the next rehearsal, but is for the drums, for the percussionist to really set the energy while we're fixed on a particular mode that we might that we've learned from other musicians that are from, I guess, the Western parts of Asia, so sort of closer to, you know, Persian or Arabic music, the modes that they use, and we try to figure out what multiple conversations in a market might be like amongst people, but using this mode, and so we'll create an atmosphere of that. When there's a moment in the narration that Ben says, again, I apologize for this to be kind of crude, but there's a moment where somebody is struck for doing something that maybe that person should not have done. And that's a great moment for us to have a cut in the music. So we try to find those dramatic moments and then reset the atmosphere again and so on and so forth. And actually storytelling, there are moments where the storyteller might say, and then they walked on, which gives music a chance to actually create that journey until the next point in the story. So.
This sounds halfway between sort of improvisational cooking, adding flavors, but more maybe like the pianist in the silent movie theater, seeing the guy standing on the cliff and what do we play for that? You know, they're falling in love. What do we do with this?
Yeah.
And it's going to be continuous and it's going to sound like music. And she's watching the screen and
right. I think the trick is always that you can't overwhelm the story with the music. You can't layer too much, and so it's always a delicate balance between, you know, the word as being the foreground and then the music as being something that also has its life and tells a story in parallel to the words. But you just cannot have them going simultaneously, and that's something you learn over doing it over and over again.
So imagine a moment in the butterfly story or the fisherman story when somebody needs a little traveling music or a little heartbreak music or a little miracle music, and they turn to you. Code this. Here's your moment.
Right. Okay. Traveling music. Okay. Traveling. Where are we traveling from?
We're going from the country to the city.
Country to the city. Okay. Let me play something.
I think we got there.
Oftentimes when we think about traveling too, if there was a percussionist with me, there's a nice way of sort of setting up a tempo that suggests a procession or walking tempo and get a little bit more intense as we approach the city. Maybe one simple way of explaining what music really tries to do is to transport us somewhere. And so, you take yourself out of your normal surroundings, whatever it is, what your life is, what your daily life is, and there's a moment where music allows you, hopefully, if you're creating good music, it allows you to sort of go into a completely different zone of imagination. This is a Kazakh melody, Yantsi, Swallow Song. Kazakh melody, which has some resemblance to sort of the folk music of Japan in this instrument, but it kind of allows me to take this melody and think about ways in which traditional performance practices of this instrument might apply.
In the concert, we're telling five stories. What is new is that in these past few weeks, we've been able to combine the stories with music, so that it's integrated music and story for some of these pieces. And we've taken one of the pieces is a story of two shepherds in Wales. One falls asleep, and the one who's awake looks down and sees something coming out of the nose of the sleeping shepherd, and it's a bee. And the bee goes flying off, and he follows the bee, and then the bee eventually comes back, disappears up the nose of the sleeping shepherd, and the shepherd wakes up and says, "I've had a dream," and it seems that his soul has gone into this bee and travelled and then come back, because the dream recounts exactly the journey, but what he saw and how he interpreted that journey was completely differently. Well, we've got this happening in Wales, and then we've got a Japanese story about somebody who buys a dream of somebody. It's exactly the same thing. A butterfly comes out of his nose, but the soul is somehow transported in the form of another animal. And this story is found amongst the Cathars in southern France, and there they believe the soul takes the form of a lizard, which comes out of somebody's ear. And so it's an idea that's travelled very far. So we've made a composite version. We've set it vaguely in China, but it's not very specific. It's a forest hillside, and we've made a very sweet comedic story out of that, with a lot of musical interpretation. So we get the journey one way, and then we get the journey another way, and that's all conveyed through sound.
In the multimedia age, Ben, I take it that everybody wants to do more than a simple role. Art students want to bring their instruments. Furniture makers want to be part of a theatrical presentation. God knows some of those musicians in the Silk Road thing may want to tell stories too, or paint.
Yeah.
What's the soup being put together here?
I don't think it's soup. I mean, you know, if you... look at the word opera. It's connected to operation. It means the works, literally. the opera was, I think, the culmination of multimedia pre-electricity. Here you had theatre, dance, visuals. When you look at Chinese opera, it really means the theatre of all arts. There's acrobats, there's everything is brought there. So it's nothing new. It's just that the technologies are new. The fact that people specialize in one area, modern technologies make it, they accelerate the possibilities of learning, whereas beforehand it would take a lifetime to master a certain art. There are things now that can be mastered rather more rapidly, so it is possible to become somebody who's multi-talented. So I think in a way, it's new and it's not new. We're just bringing possibilities for using everything to tell a story with. Just to give you a little story to explain this mystery of how stories travel, a very dear friend of mine, a Scottish traveller storyteller called Duncan Williamson, who died last November at the age of 81, was telling me a story, a Jack tale. And when he tells you stories, he's very physical. He actually almost holds you in his arms and fills you full of rather strong beer and makes you smoke, even though you don't smoke cigarettes. And he was telling me, "Ben, it's a fantastic story. It tells of how Jack, he lives alone with his mother. His father's gone off, and there's a story in that, but we're not going to go into those details. And Jack comes of age, and he has to set off to seek his fortune. And as he's about to go, his mother says, 'Wait, my son. Before your father left, he gave me these things to give to you.' And she opens a cupboard, and she pulls out your father's shaving mirror, your father's sword, and your father's old pair of tackety boots. And she pulls out a pair of hobnail boots with doves wings on, dove's wings, and gives them to Jack. And Jack, he puts them on, and he puts the sword through his belt, and he puts the shaving mirror into his pocket, and he sets out into the world to seek his fortune. And he's not gone very far when he comes to the top of the hill, and there's a hideous old henwife with snakes writhing in her hair, and she's surrounded by rocks and boulders. And I said, hang on, Duncan, this isn't a Scots traveller tale. This is a Greek myth. It's not a Greek myth. It is a Greek myth. It's not a Greek myth. It was a traveller tale. It always is. It always was. It always will be. And I said, no, Duncan, it's a Greek myth. He says, well, how do you know? And I said, well, I'll tell you what happens next. So I told him what happened next. And he said, how did you know that? And I said, because it's a Greek myth. So we had a little discussion. Where did you hear it from, Duncan? And he heard it from his Uncle Willie. His Uncle Willie had been in the trenches in the First World War. And suddenly the whole mystery of the transmission of stories is explained. Because here are men from all social classes thrown together in the most appalling conditions imaginable, with bullets and bombs and blood and rats, talking about everything and anything to keep their minds off the horror. And the officer class, the stories that they know, classical Greek mythology. So they tell those stories, they're good stories. But the traveller man, there he is, he listens. He's never seen a schoolboy wrapped in a white sheet or a classical piece of Greek art. He visualises it in terms of his own cultural reference, which is black jackets and tackety hobnail boots. And so the story jumps immediately from one culture into another. And that has happened on these trade routes forever, from time immemorial. There were sailors taken into ships whose skill was to sing songs, entertain and tell stories. They were there as a sort of contemporary thing would be the DVD player in a ship. But no, these guys got extra pay or extra food or extra drink to tell stories.
A definition of victory in a collaboration like the one with the RISD students? I mean, will you know when you've rung the bell?
Hopefully the bell will be rung. I mean, it's really interesting, this ring of truth. There is something about sound which is so perfect. I live in envy of musicians because they can travel all over the world. They don't have to speak a language. And me as a storyteller, I'm completely inhibited by language. A painter can also travel all over the world, show an image and get a response. But word, it has limitation as well as great possibility. And musicians can, I think, more than perhaps in any other art form, just play a sequence of notes so perfectly that inexplicably you weep or you smile. Or you relax, or you become tense. It's almost scientific. There are sort of vibrations that they release. We have in the ensemble, you know, musicians who are of absolutely the greatest quality in the world. And I sit there and I listen sometimes to how the violins are playing, and it's quite extraordinary. They are ringing my bell. Literally, I am resonating with the resonance that's in their string.
What's the common moral, so to speak, of what the Silk Road Project does and what you do in establishing and linking in a kind of, if I may say, open source manner, so many story elements and musical forms?
Well, I think if it works, basically, we have so many skills available, And one of the projects that we did was to look at the story of blue and white porcelain, blue and white plates across the world, starting, I think, I can't remember now the exact dates, but they start in Iraq. There was a technological discovery to do with glazes that then was developed in China, and then an appreciation developed in Persia and backwards and forwards, and then the Europeans encountered it and they liked this art, and everything counter-influenced each other until you get the evolution of things that have an authenticity to themselves. I think authenticity means true to itself, true to yourself, auto, author, authenticity. And I think that what we're looking at is creating from what is available now, from all the traditions, from all this information that we, you know, no other period of history have human beings had access to so much information from which to make choices, to choose, to select, to put together. So we try to create things that work, that are not pastiches, that are not contrived, but that have a sort of, they draw on the strengths of, if you like, globalization and the knowledge that is here, to create not a soup or a hybrid or a homogenized nothing, but something that is exact, specific, strong, clear, and complete. Pieces of work, that audiences, that is good.
The theme underlying it seems to be not only a global understanding of the species, but also this open source exchange of ideas. Nobody owns these musical phrases or saraband forms or, you know, thematic stories of a search or a journey. They are a common treasury. Is it the same lesson from music and from stories?
Well, this becomes, and I have to speak very personally, I can't speak on behalf of the Silk Road Ensemble here, but, you know, my whole storytelling ethos is counter absolutely everything that is destroying this planet now, which is I'm against copyright. I'm involved in an interpretive and reinterpretive, recreational art form. These stories belong to everybody. And the reason that they've lasted so long, really from Stone Age times to the present day, some of these stories, is that they contain in them the essence of human experience. That's what we respond to, the truth of a situation, or the comedy of a situation, or the horror, or the plight, or the pity of a situation. And in a sense, that is always contemporary. Pain and loss and the joy of retrieval has been going on ever since human beings have had relationships. And I don't think we have to create new work all the time. There's this huge repository of that which already exists. It's not sustainable to create new work all the time. It's not sustainable to hold everything or sell everything. You know, if we're not going to destroy this planet, we have to share what is there. And in terms of the riches of art and imagination, it's all been done before. And, you know, what is new is that people haven't met it before. So when you encounter something for the first time, there is your newness. There's nothing wrong with recycling.
Nothing wrong with thinking of it as a eternal human treasury either. Ben Hegarty, thank you enormously for the work you do and for joining us in Providence.
Well, thank you. Thank you.